May it please the court, Alan Gura for the appellants. Seated with me at council table is Candace Hance, and I've reserved 3 minutes of time for rebuttal. The appellants...
Let me ask you something right off the bat, and that is, when you describe the Second Amendment Foundation, you say that it is made up of 650 members and supporters residing throughout the United States. The complaint does not say that... in other words, your own description is they have to be residents, or do they? You also say that Dearth is a member. Now, do you have non-resident members?
Yes, we do have non-resident members, Your Honor. Mr. Dearth is one of them. It's true that we do have many members residing throughout the United States.
So your description in the corporate disclosure statement has over 650,000 members in the United States and others besides.
That's correct, right. Your Honor. And, of course, it's important to note, Your Honor, that one of the claims that we have in this case is not just the Second Amendment claim, but we also claim that these laws impose an unconstitutional condition upon the right of international travel, which the Supreme Court recognized in Kent v. Dulles. There is a body of law that states that the right of international travel cannot be conditioned upon with the forfeiture of other rights, and the Second Amendment right would be one of those. And the members and supporters of the Second Amendment Foundation who reside in the United States definitely also enjoy the right of international travel, as the individual plaintiff in this case does as well.
Did you say just Kent versus Dulles just now?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is that in your brief? I don't remember.
No, it's not, because we're not here on the substantive merits.
Kent versus Dulles went off on a clear statement requirement, didn't it?
Kent versus Dulles upheld the right. We're not presenting any argument today on the substantive merits of the complaint, because the district court never reached those.
Right. But let's get back on your track then.
Sure. We would very much welcome the opportunity to come back before the court, and in fact, we believe that the district court should hear these arguments. They are serious arguments. We were able, in the companion case in Texas once, to actually brief it on summary judgment. But in any event, here we're only prepared to argue standing, which is the issue. And the appellants plainly have standing in this case for two reasons. First, the challenged laws have been enforced against Plaintiff Dearth. And second, even though by virtue of the plaintiff's abstention from constitutionally protected conduct, the prosecution is not imminent, the injury in fact is imminent, and in fact the injury is itself ongoing. With respect to the first basis for standing, on January 28, 2006, Stephen Dearth's attempt to buy a gun was thwarted by the defendant's enforcement of the challenge laws. Now, Dearth subsequently contacted the FBI and asked if he could purchase guns, and he was told no. And when Dearth first sued the government back in Ohio, the government took the position that venue should be based upon the location of the failed transaction. They suggested the District of Minnesota, because that is where something had occurred, even though the venue statute speaks to the location of omissions as well as actual occurrences. The Justice Department believed that something had transpired. And in fact, the Justice Department had another argument on the venue challenge, one arguing that venue should be transferred for reasons of convenience. And again, of course, the convenience venue transfer statute applies only if the case is transferred to a district which has jurisdiction. You cannot select a venue that lacks jurisdiction, and there's plenty of case law on that. In any event, subsequently, in June of 2007, Dearth again tried to buy a gun, this time in Ohio, and again he found that the challenge laws are in effect. So the administrative denial of permission to obtain a firearm, like all administrative denials, constitutes an injury in fact, and there is not really much more to say on this point. I believe the case can be submitted on this point alone. Parker is, in fact, conclusive on this. Now, this is not to say that it is necessary to try to test the law. It is not necessary that Mr. Dearth actually attempted to purchase firearms, because the courts have something that we follow called the futile act doctrine, a doctrine exemplified in this circuit best perhaps by the case of Grid Radio versus Zaka, in the Second Circuit case of Bach versus Pataki, which actually involved a gun permit, is directly on point. Basically, when the law states in clear and uncertain terms that people are not entitled to a permit, there is no need to engage in a ritualistic exercise where the outcome is foreordained. Now, if this were, in this circuit, perhaps a First Amendment case or If this case had in fact arisen in any other circuit, the facial disqualification from the permit would be enough. There would be no question that there would be that there is standing in this case. Now, the constitutional injury is in fact ongoing. Dearth is presently refraining from acquiring guns because doing so would violate the law. The government has not claimed, nor would it ever claim, that Dearth is free to ignore Title 18. Instead, the government posits that Dearth is in the position of either refraining from exercising his rights or risking criminal prosecution. But this predicament is exactly what the Declaratory Judgment Act was designed to terminate in no uncertain terms. The Declaratory Judgment Act's text is plain and clear. It states, and I quote, "In a case of actual controversy within its jurisdiction, any court in the United States, upon the filing of an appropriate pleading, may declare the rights and other legal relations of any interested party seeking such declaration, whether or not further relief is or could be sought." Well, we clearly have an injury in fact. Over and over and over again, the Supreme Court has instructed that when an individual refrains from arguably constitutional conduct out of a credible fear of prosecution, it's that omission, that coercion, that constitutes an Article III injury. And the latest example of this from the Supreme Court is very clear and unmistakable. I quote from the language in MedImmune. This is 549. MedImmune versus Genentech. This is at the 549 U.S. at page 129. "The plaintiff's own action or inaction in failing to violate the law eliminates the imminent threat of prosecution, but nonetheless does not eliminate Article III jurisdiction." That language could not possibly be clearer. The court has always spoken of the need for an injury to be imminent as opposed to hypothetical, but it's the injury that needs to be imminent, not the prosecution. The government is simply not in a position these days to be vague and ambiguous and to sit back and not reveal its intentions and thereby bar civil rights plaintiffs from accessing the courts of the United States. I see I'm in my rebuttal period, and I'll reserve, if there are no questions from the court, I'll reserve the time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thanks.
Good morning. Anisha Desgupta for Appley, Eric Holder, and with me at council table is Mark Stern. The plaintiff's complaint fails for reasons that relate to fundamental principles of Article III standing and essentially have nothing to do with the merits of this case. Namely, their complaint makes none of the showings necessary to establish their standing to sue. The complaint provides no information at all about where or when Stephen Dearth seeks to purchase a firearm, and it also fails to identify any actions that the Second Amendment Foundation has been required to undertake because of the challenged restrictions. The complaint also fails to identify any members of the Second Amendment Foundation who've been affected by the challenged restrictions. And under these circumstances, the district court properly concluded that the plaintiffs lack standing to sue. Information about where Stephen Dearth plans to purchase the firearm is important because there are states in which state law independently prohibits non-resident purchases of firearms.
Is Ohio one of them?
Ohio does contain restrictions on who can purchase firearms. In the Ohio Revised Code, the provision on interstate transactions in firearms lists a number of states, the states contiguous to Ohio, whose residents are permitted to purchase firearms there, but Ohio does contain certain residency requirements for a purchase. And
those contiguous states include the province of Ontario?
They do not, Your Honor. They include Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Pennsylvania, or West Virginia. And that citation is not in our brief, but I can provide it to the court now if that would be helpful.
I think we can find it.
So depending on where Mr. Dearth...
The complaint says that Mr. Dearth intends to purchase firearms within the United States, which he would store securely at his relative's home in Mount Vernon, Ohio, and which he would access for lawful sporting purposes as well as for other purposes.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's wrong with that?
Well, it refers to where he would intend to store the firearms, but it doesn't refer to where he would purchase them. It just says within the United States. So depending on the state, there might be a state law that would be an independent bar to the purchase. And in that case,
he would go to a state that would not independently bar the purchase, since that would frustrate his intentions.
Well, at this stage, Your Honor, it's purely hypothetical. He hasn't provided the court with the information necessary to make that determination, to establish that he actually...
Do you seriously doubt that he's determined to acquire a gun if allowed?
Well, in this case, we're limited to the allegations in the complaint. And,
you know... I understand that based on his desire to saying he wants to buy a gun in the U.S. and store it in Ohio. And you think that that's insufficient to establish that he wants to buy a gun at a place where he could lawfully buy a gun?
Well, he may have an intention, but all he's established in his complaint is the type of someday intention.
Well, he's already tried.
Someday was yesterday.
Yeah, he's both tried twice and alleges an intent to do so again. I don't know, what are we supposed to list the specific address of a store?
Well, at the very least, perhaps, to provide information about the states, this court can establish that the challenged federal law is, in fact, the reason for his injury and not some independent...
This was not the district court's theory, by the way, right?
The district court decided, based on the frame of this case, as a pre-enforcement challenge. But we don't need to reach those issues here because the complaint is deficient for reasons that they don't even rise to that threshold. So these basic principles of standing are principles that are applicable to all plaintiffs that have nothing to do with...
The fact that he tried to purchase already put this in the Parker box rather than the Navigar box?
Well, Your Honor, the fact that he's purchased it already doesn't establish his eligibility for prospective relief, and that's a well-established principle. In Parker, what made the difference was the fact that the plaintiff who did have standing there, Mr. Heller, had sought registration of a firearm from the District of Columbia and was not able to obtain it. So
too here, Mr. Dirth sought to purchase the firearm and was not able to obtain it because the seller wouldn't sell in violation of the government law.
Well, the way that the court framed Mr. Heller's injury in the Parker case was to refer to it as an administrative denial. And now, I understand plaintiffs invoke that doctrine here, but properly framed, administrative denial does involve some transaction between an individual and a governmental entity of some sort. And the notion of an administrative denial is that someone has sought a license or a permit or some benefit from the government, and the government has either actively denied that or constructively denied it by not acting on it. Here in the complaint, Mr. Dirth hasn't alleged that he tried to submit any form to any government body, that there was any form that he would have submitted if not for these restrictions.
How would he have done that? I don't understand. The seller was the one that gave him the form. He couldn't fill it out correctly or satisfactorily because of the requirement that he claims is unlawful. So where was he going to submit a form to the government?
Well, Mr. Dirth himself is not under any obligation to submit any forms or applications as part of the scheme, as far as he's alleged in his complaint. His complaint just alleges that in the past, he went to a seller, indicated that he wished to buy a firearm, and the seller asked him about his state of residence, and when he said he could not provide a state of residence.
So if he had alleged in the complaint, let's suppose he had alleged in the complaint that he was wanted to purchase at a particular store and there would be no independent state bar, would he then have standing?
Well, presuming that he had provided this court with the information to determine that there's no state bar, there would still be the question of, you know, whether he'd adequately alleged when he intended to purchase the firearm. So to say just that...
Suppose he did that. I want to purchase on December 12th at 2 p.m. at the following store on Main Street in a state that doesn't have a bar. Is that good enough?
Well, under those circumstances, he may very well have standing, but that hypothetical highlights the deficiencies in this complaint, the fact that the court isn't in a position to know.
So you're not really resting on the Navigar decision then?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the basic problem here is that courts have developed tests for Article III standing, and these plaintiffs have not met them, to allow someone who's outside the United States to challenge a U.S. law on the basis of a someday intention to engage in some future conduct would be a significant expansion of the standing doctrine. And that's what the plaintiffs seek here. And the government's position is that, you know, no court has ever permitted plaintiffs to show standing on the basis of such tenuous allegations, and this court should not either. Appellants referred to the membership of the Second Amendment Foundation, and it's relevant to note that the complaint itself does not in fact contain any allegations about the Second Amendment Foundation's membership beyond stating that it has over 650,000 members and supporters nationwide. And the complaint also says that Mr. Dearth doesn't have a residence in the United States. So while appellants have suggested in their reply brief that perhaps Mr. Dearth could be a member of the Second Amendment Foundation, there's no basis for that in the complaint or in the record of the case.
They say he is on page, twice in fact, page 5 and on page 16.
That's correct, Your Honor, but they don't cite to anything in the complaint or to the record of this case. And for these purposes, for an evaluation of standing, the court is limited to the allegations in the complaint.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very briefly, Your Honors, this question about the intent to return to the United States was actually answered by this court in the Ord case. In the Ord case, the District of Columbia, Mr. Kim, who was here earlier, made the very same argument. And I'm quoting here, this is at page 1143 of the Ord decision in the federal reports. Ord never alleges in so many words that he intends to enter the District of Columbia while armed, but at this stage of the litigation, we must make all reasonable inferences in Ord's favor. And then the court goes on to discuss it, and the conclusion is, here again, this is the court's opinion in Ord. Moreover, Ord's request for relief, a declaratory judgment, and an injunction prohibiting the District of Columbia from enforcing its firearm laws against him makes sense only if he actually intends to return to D.C. while armed to serve his clients. We thus conclude that Ord has standing to bring his pre-enforcement claim. This is exactly the same story here. This is a gentleman who lives in Winnipeg. He has a family here. He states in the complaint that he visits regularly. He clearly has an absolute right to enter the country. He's an American citizen, and he does enter the country twice on different trips. He's tried to purchase firearms while entering the country, and it's not as though his desire to return to the U.S. is some speculative thing. I mean, he clearly alleges that he is going to purchase a gun in the United States. This is a federal law that is binding throughout the United States. And there are many states, in fact, most states would probably allow him to have a gun. The reference to this Ohio law actually mirrors the old version of Title 18, Section 922, and I believe it was subsection B. We do, by the way, have a challenge in this case as well, to 922B3 right now. And let me briefly advise the court what this does. Under the Gun Control Act of 1968, previously, people could not purchase firearms in states where they didn't reside, but they could purchase long arms in contiguous states. Now, under the current version of 922B3, people can purchase any long arm in any other state under federal law, so long as the transaction complies with the laws of both states. But handguns are still, you have to have, you can only purchase in your own state or take delivery from a dealer in your own state. So for example, if as a resident of Virginia, I were to go to California and try to buy a rifle, the dealer there would have to make sure that the transaction complies with Virginia law and California law. However, if I tried to purchase a handgun, then I could not take delivery of the handgun. The handgun would have to be shipped to a licensed firearms dealer in Virginia, and only then the transfer would take effect. And so sometimes we see state laws that try to mirror this image. But generally speaking, we are challenging, of course, B3, because we believe that if you have a right to buy a handgun, it should not be restricted to simply getting one in the state where you reside. But the reason we have this question 13 on the form, it's designed to be a mechanism to try to enforce this idea that that the dealer knows whose laws he has to obey or whether or not, given the type of arm being purchased, it can even be done. Now, this form, of course, the form that Mr. Dearth was provided and could not complete, is a form printed and supplied by the ATF, Form 4473. The very fact that it's given by a private actor, in this case,
isn't that private actor licensed?
Yes, the private actor is licensed.
Why don't you make that argument, that it is an administrative denial, one step removed?
It is. I will make that argument, and I do make that argument. Thank you, Your Honor. We claim it's a distinction without a difference, and so yes. And in fact, even if there were no such removal, MedImmune was a private denial case. The Supreme Court there held that even private parties who engage in conduct can, in fact, create Article III standing, and that's in MedImmune, of course, versus Genentech. No government officials involved in that case. If there are no further questions, we submit. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you both. The case is submitted.